This is lecture number four. And we begin in the middle of transparency 2.6 or two-thirds of the way down. We're going to talk about another formulation. For the moment, we'll set H bar equal to unity. This is the resolution of unity for coherent states. The richness of these projection operators, there are so many of them, they are overcomplete, means that you can actually represent any operator by a weighted superposition of the projection operators. That's something you cannot do, certainly, with a traditional representation associated with a self-adjoint operator. So let's do that for the Hamiltonian and have a symbol, an associated phase space function here, whose weight with these projection operators gives you the Hamiltonian. Add these two equations with a suitable coefficient and you get the third equation. Now we begin to make an approximation. We're going to raise this as an exponent, so we make an order epsilon squared error. And we do the same on the right-hand side, and we again have an order epsilon squared error. So this equation is approximate, and it's not exact. I'm going to use it, however, in this coherent state matrix element of the evolution operator. Remember, H bar is 1 for the moment. I break that into many time steps, and for each of those time steps, I use this formula for the description of the term. And that leads us to an expression of the following kind. There are coherent state overlaps. I have an exponential of this symbol small h, which was associated with this so-called diagonal representation. This is a perfectly fine lattice space formulation for the propagator to account for the fact that we made errors in order epsilon squared. We will have to take a limit n equals n goes to infinity in order to get a correct evaluation. However, being physicists, we cannot resist the temptation to interchange the limiting order with the integrations, and we're going to write down the formal path integral that we obtained for continuous and differentiable paths. This first term leads to exactly the same kind of term it led to before, because where these for continuous paths, these labels are very close to each other, the vectors are very close to each other, and that the overlap of those was basically this phase vector. We now have for our Hamiltonian the small h factor here, integration, and you remember this from long ago. That's nothing but pq dot, the kinematical form of interest, and we have a formal integral representation for our path integral obtained here, but now we have a different symbol. This symbol is associated with a diagonal representation. The previous formula we had, I used a capital H, and that was associated with the diagonal expectation value in the coherent sense. You shouldn't wedge yourself to the meaning of the upper or the lower case. I'm going to confuse those a little bit later on, but you should be aware of which one you're talking about all the time. Anyway, the fact that this formula for the same expression has a different symbol simply means that we're dealing with a formal expression, and if you give this the proper lattice interpretation, it will indeed generate the right result. I want to do it one more time. One more time to give you an expression for a path integral, and I'm going to do it in a different way. Continuous time regularization is the goal. Not this lattice time regularization that we have up here. You'll see what I mean later by when we have a continuous time regularization. But this time I'm going to do it by means of an analog system, a real physical problem, an analog system. I'm going to consider a classical two-dimensional particle moving in a potential V and a magnetic field B. So here X and Y are my coordinates. For example, the top of this table could be called the surface, X and Y, and the magnetic field B points perpendicular to that surface. These are charged particles. So R, my position vector, has X, Y components. B has the only thing with a Z component pointing out of that plane. The vector potential is given here b times x in the second component. Remember, curl of A is b, so that's how connection of A and B come about. V is my potential depending on x and y, and I'm going to write Newton's equations. Newton's equations for this classical system. Mr double dot is minus gradient of the potential plus r cross b, and I will set the charge and the speed of light equal to 1. That's a two system equation. That is to say, this vector stands for x and y components, and it's second order in time. Now I'm going to do something which a theorist can do, but an experimentalist can't do. I'm going to let the mass go to zero in this equation, just set m equal to zero. When I do that, I can put the grad v on the other side and have this equation. R dot cross v is grad v. This equation has now gone from second order in time derivatives to first order in time derivatives. It still has two components, and I write them over here. By dot is dv by dx. Bx dot is minus dv by dy. This equation should kind of look familiar to you. In fact, they should look like Hamilton's equations. If I take square root of b, b is simply the magnitude of the magnetic field here in these units of E c equal 1, times x and call that p, square root of b times y and call that q, v of x and y, then I call h of p and q. These two equations become these two equations. This is the Newton's equation for a system with 2 degrees of freedom. It moves in the x and y plane. However, when the mass goes to zero, and of course I need a magnetic field to play this game, when the mass goes to zero, I get Hamilton's equations for a single degree of freedom. It moves in one dimension, one coordinate q and one momentum p. So we're going to use that in a very practical way in just a moment. Let's take the quantization of this physical system here about the magnetic field. And for that, we can take an initial wave function in the xy plane, look at the wave function in the xy plane at a later time t by means of the propagator, and here we can use Feynman's original formula. This is a free particle, m over 2 r dot squared at x and y coordinates. In the presence of a magnetic field, that's how you write it in the Lagrangian form, minus the potential, that takes care of the potential. So that's the full propagator of that, and that can make sense. We can make sense out of that, say, by a lattice function. I want to take the limit m to 0, because that was my trick for changing this 2 degree of freedom system into a single degree of freedom system for Hamilton mechanics. But since I'm up in this form of dealing with m, and already the equation is conditionally convergent, I hope you know what that means. It means that I could put absolute values, here's one of them, here's another one, in the integrand, and that as a phase factor, and that absolute value of that phase factor is unity, then I get an integral which diverges. So this integral needs help in converging. We'll talk about that again, but that's my point here. It needs help. And one way to do that is to let m go to im, and then let it go to zero. So I've done that here. I've said m is imaginary, so it now comes separately as a real coefficient with a correct sign of the I to make it damping. And now I have this equation here, phase factor here, this part coming from the over here, and I'm going to let m go to zero. However, to get the full impact out of this, let's change the names. We have one lady in the room. Let's say her name was Helen. I don't know what it is. Doesn't matter. But she would be the same person if she was Joyce. Okay? I'm just changing the names of the characters involved. So where I have x, I'm going to multiply it by square root of b, call that p. Make this transformation to q, and v goes to h, now a function of p and q, and I'm going to change m to capital B divided by nu, and so my propagator becomes a point in the phase space plane, p prime q prime to p double q double from 0 to t, and my integrand just taking exactly what this, because this only had a second component here, p q dot minus h. And over here, this becomes p dot squared plus q dot squared divided by this parameter here. And taking m to 0 is the same as letting nu go to infinity. So that's my new expression for a potential quantity here. Moreover, we recognize that this is really an ingredient in the Feynman-Katz formula. Feynman-Katz formula had no I's in part of its term over here, and we could absorb these quantities into the curly dp, the curly dq, with most of this normalization to make a bona fide, a genuine measure. This is a measure on two dimensions. It's actually a measure on a flat space. You can see it there, dp squared plus dq squared. That's your Cartesian coordinates with a metric. And so this is two-dimensional Brownian motion down here, which I will symbolize this way, d mu, depending on the parameter nu, which is actually the diffusion constant in Brownian motion. W stands for Wiener, p and q, these two coordinates on the plane. And the thing that's being integrated in that measure is this phase vector here. We have to clean up with a few other factors in front, but these are finite factors. This one was no longer, this was originally not finite at all. This was a formal quantity. But this is now a bona fide, a finite set of numbers. I've written not pq dot times dt, but pdq. If any of you know things about stochastic variables, p and q are Brownian motion paths. They are continuous but nowhere differentiable. So strictly speaking, q dot doesn't make a good sense. But pdq has a bona fide meaning as a stochastic integral. It can either be done by Ito or Stratonovich prescription. We will take the Stratonovich prescription in a moment. In any case, the point of all that is that this is an absolutely well-defined integral. Well, so what? What does it mean? We don't know that. Let's try to evaluate it, or at least mentally try to evaluate it, and see what it means. It turns out that this is an integral representation for the coherent state matrix element of the evolution operator, e to the iht. This equation also tells you what is the definition of the states, the coherent states involved. They come with this particular ordering of the symbols. It also tells you that the operators Q and P satisfies the Heisenberg relation. That all can be read out of this equation. And moreover, that the fiducial vector in the coherent states is given by Q plus IP, acting on that is 0, namely, that's the ground state of an ordinary harmonic oscillator. All of that miraculously is contained in this formula. Okay, one more thing that's contained in there is the connection of the Hamiltonian operator here with the symbol HPQ representing it, and that's by this diagonal representation. Okay, why is that valuable? Oh, by the way, this is a solution to the Schrödinger equation for a very, very wide class of Hamiltonians. Why is that valuable? Well, I'll tell you why it's valuable. Because that expression is covariant under canonical coordinate transformations. Here is the formula. This is the path integral. This is what it equals, the coherent state matrix element of the evolution operator. And this is the symbolic functional form we give to that. Now, let's pass to alternative canonical coordinates. We did that long ago. We changed our P and Q labels to P bar and Q bar. P bar is a function of P and Q, or conversely, P is a function of P bar and Q bar. Just our alternative set of coordinates we lay on our phase space. We did it in such a way that the vectors were unchanged. It was the coherent state, the same vector in the Hilbert space, we just gave it another name. So that is the functional form. But of course, these things being functions of these variables will change the nature of the left-hand side. This will be a new function of the new variables, which label the points on the phase space at the beginning of the time set 0 and at the end of the time set capital T. What about the integral equation? Well, we can do that as follows. You remember PDQ, we talked about long ago, under a coordinate transformation and how that's connected. It's a so-called one form, and that one form is imaged as P bar DQ bar plus DG bar of P bar Q bar. This is the generator in the terminology of the canonical transformation connecting this pair of coordinates with those pair of coordinates. H transforms like a scalar. So H goes over to a new function of the new variables whose numerical value is identical to the old function at the of the old variables at the same point in phase space. You might like to know, or might be worried, that if P and Q are actually not smooth, continuous, and differentiable functions, but Brownian motion paths, whether it is actually true that PDQ equals P bar DQ bar plus DG bar. That's a classical concept in stochastic, in classical analysis. If you use the Stratonovich so-called midpoint rule for multiplication of stochastic variables, I admit this may not be familiar to too many of you, then the ordinary rules of calculus apply. So indeed, you can use this standard classical formula in this appropriate sense. Over here we have the measure, Brownian motion on the flat plane, originally expressed in Cartesian coordinates, but now expressed in curvilinear coordinates, with coefficients A, B, and C, which can depend on the points P and Q. Even so, this new metric is equivalent to this metric. This one is corresponds to a flat space, so this still corresponds to a flat space. And in the same fashion as before, we have the original Hamiltonian in this diagonal representation connected with the symbol and the integration over the projection operators. Now in the new coordinates, the Liouville version, Liouville formula tells us that dB dQ becomes dP bar dQ bar. This state is the same state, just new names here and here. So this transforms as a scalar to the new function, which gives us the same Hamiltonian. I would venture to bet you have not seen in your life a formulation of quantum mechanics which is canonically coordinate invariant. And to my knowledge, this is the first kind. How does it come about? How is it possible? And I tell you, the answer is simple. Because I have made this formula from a simple transcription from x, y to p and q of a genuine physical problem. What does that got to do with anything? Take this equation on the board, 3 plus 4 equals 7. How many of you would risk your life on the validity of that equation? I don't see many hands up. If I say that there are 3 people in this row and 4 people in that row, and add that together, everybody will agree that the sum is 7. But if I tell you this is the x component of a certain vector, this is the y component of a certain vector, and this is a z component of a certain vector in a particular coordinate frame, you know this is accidental. Because change the coordinate frame, you will get new numbers here, and it is highly unlikely they will add up, have an equality sign. My problem of the magnetic field and a charged particle on a plane was a physical construct. Of course, I can't set M to zero in real life. In fact, in the experimental laboratories, people make B extremely large. That's what they can do. And B being extremely large is rather like M towards zero. That's the quantum Hall effect that I'm describing. Okay. Okay, let's tackle this concept of conditionally convergent integral again. Here's a familiar integral you should have seen and know how to calculate. E to the I y squared divided by 2, say, dy plus to minus infinity. Again, it is absolutely not convergent. Put in vertical bars here. Take the phase factor equal to 1. You get a divergence. The only way that can add up to a finite number is by selected cancellation between plus infinity and minus infinity. I could arrange the way I do the integral, and I challenge you to ask me this, in order to get any complex number in the plane you would like. Well, we teach calculus too. So what do we do for the calculus youngsters? I tell them, you put in finite limits, L minus L1 at the bottom, plus L2 at the top. That's an integral you know exists. And then you take the limit as L1 goes to infinity, L2 goes to infinity separately, and you see if you get an answer. And then that would be the definition. That's the Riemann prescription for non-absolutely convergent integrals. You can also do it by putting in a convergence factor, e to the minus y squared divided by 2 nu here. This is a Gaussian. This makes the integrand integrable. If I take the absolute value inside, I have this term behind, and that's proper. And this integral I can do. These are a little more complicated. This one I can do. And I take a limit as nu goes to infinity, I get the standard answer, square root of 2 pi I. Okay, so conditionally convergent integrals need help. Let's look at Feynman's 1950 proposal in the same way. Here is his path integral for the phase space formula. Let's not say what it equals, because how can we say what it equals? Because we don't know how to define it in the first place. I tell you there's no mathematics in this expression. The best prescription for this is 0. These are not defined as true measures. This quantity is generally infinite, etc., etc. There's no physics in this expression either, believe it or not, because it doesn't tell you which set of coordinates to use. It actually looks canonically coordinate covariant. Change it to other coordinates over here, p bar, q bar, Hamiltonian up here, etc. Looks the same from classical analysis. But that would say that I could take an anharmonic oscillator, say p squared plus q to the fourth, and convert that by canonical transformation to p bar squared. That would make it look like a free particle. And yet we know that the quantization of a free particle is certainly not the same as the quantization of an anharmonic oscillator. So this has no good physics, no mathematics. Let's give it some help. It's a conditionally convergent integral. So we're going to put in a convergence factor. Here's another way to look at this problem that I obtained before, avenue I obtained before from the magnetic field. We're going to put in our metric p dot squared plus q dot squared. We'll have a minus factor. We'll have the nu in the denominator. So formally, as nu goes to infinity, this term would disappear. I brought along some coins to show you disappearance. It's a country I'm not used to where the money has holes in the middle, so it doesn't do very well for me. Anyway, so in the limit as nu goes to infinity, it looks like the formula before, so it's an attempt to regularize the integral. Once we put that in, we say, oh my goodness, actually we can make sense of this integral. We can make it into a Brownian motion measure. We have these factors in front. We have this term here. We understand this as stochastic integral properly. And as I've already described before, it does indeed describe a matrix element. It happens to be coherent state matrix elements. You have to choose both P and Q fixed at the beginning and the end. That was not at all obvious up here, but it becomes a price or a blessing, if you will, from putting in this kind of regularization. And it also tells you that it's a canonical story that you have operators Q and P underneath here, which obey the Heisenberg uncertainty relationship. Okay, that's just a restatement, if you will, from the point of view of an effort to make the integral well-defined. Notice that this has the virtue of being a continuous time regularization. There's no lattice of the temporal integral here. The temporal integral goes full as before. The regularization is a very different kind. That's right. It can be called continuous time regularization. However, who told you at the beginning to use a regularization which employed a flat space? dp squared plus dq squared, Cartesian flat space underneath that. Who said I had to do my quantum Hall effect on the surface of a plane? Let me try two different other geometries. I'm going to put in a different regularization here. P dot squared over 1 minus p squared slash s times h bar. You might remember this formula. We had that once before when we talked about the metric induced by spin coherent states. This was on the surface of a sphere. This is not your d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared that you're familiar with, but it's in slightly different coordinates. Anyway, this corresponds to the surface of a sphere, radius being square root of s. That's an integral. That's a regularization. That's a Brownian motion. Now not on a flat plane, but on the surface of a sphere. You're doing your quantum Hall effect, and they actually do this these days. Quantum Hall effect on a spherical two-dimensional plane with the magnetic field pointing outwards. Okay, you take the limit as nu goes to infinity. Again, where's my coin? Should not put it away. I have to pull out the... Here, it is good. All that's gone. Take the limit nu to infinity. It's another version of trying to look like the original formula on the board. What have you obtained? You have obtained spin coherent states by putting in a spin geometry. And the spin kinematics are part of those coherent states. It's not canonical operators Q and P, but spin Sj commute with Sk proportional to Sl. Here the third one. In other words, by choosing the geometry of the regularization, I have chosen a different kinematical form of quantization. Let's go further. We talked about one other set of coherent states, the affine coherent states. This was the metric they induced, dp squared times q squared, forget the beta for the moment, dq squared divided by q squared. That is a space of constant negative curvature, while this was a space of constant positive curvature. Play the same game here as a regularization. Again, as nu goes to infinity, this term is missing. It's a formulation of a different kind of regularization. And you see that you get out of this, you don't see, but you could if you worked hard, that you would get coherent states again, but they would be defined by the affine coherent states, having different kinematical behavior from the canonical or the spin. They would satisfy this commutation relation with Q being positive. Therefore, and of course, all the way along, the Hamiltonian has been the symbol associated with the operator Hamiltonian here by means of the diagonal representation. So the phase-based metric has given mathematical and physical meaning. This very introduction of this kind of regularization here gives to the formula mathematical and physical meaning, and it automatically leads to a coherent state representation. Not only are the equations covariant under canonical coordinate transformations, you can, by changing the form of the geometry of the regularization, change the kinematics of the output. Well, that has led to a paper I had the brazenness to describe as quantization is geometry, after all. Okay, in the remaining time, which is not much, unfortunately, we're going to quickly go through some evaluation of integrals. What are path integrals good for? This is one of my favorite examples, f of y given by a simple one-dimensional integral over theta here. Do we evaluate that by counting up the little rectangles underneath the curve like we teach our children in elementary calculus? No, we don't. First off, we can do a power series in y. That gives us elementary integrals and powers of cosine, which we know what to do with. We can also make a differential equation here, y times f double prime. You can read it. Here the boundary conditions, f of 0 equals 1, f prime of 0 is 0. Look that up in a table. That's the Bessel function. So you don't evaluate integrals. You indirectly determine what they are. Same thing for path integrals. Here is a path integral back to the original Feynman formula. It is, what is it? It's the x representation of the evolution operator here, x matrix element of the evolutionary operator. If I put in, let's assume this Hamiltonian has only discrete states, I put the complete set of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian in, then this formula is given by a sum of the eigenfunctions and the eigenvalues here. That's why it's such an important quantity, because it contains, in essence, all of the eigenfunctions and all the eigenvalues. Well, sometimes this sum can actually be carried out. You can do it in closed form. And that has led to a table of path integrals. And I tell you that that's a good centimeter and a half thick of path integrals that people have now evaluated by being able to use this formula and summing up this expression. So this is an evaluation of the integral not by counting area underneath, but by some indirect means. Now, in the remaining time, I want to devote my attention to a semi-classical approximation of path integrals. There's a phase, you're integrating over a phase, e to the I by h bar of something. If h bar was a small quantity, you would think stationary phase kind of approximations would contribute the most important part, and that's the idea of what we're going to be looking at. To do that, however, it's convenient to give you three representations to carry along in your mind. Abstract vector psi in the x basis was what we call psi of x. Abstract vector psi in the p basis, what we call, let's call it psi tilde of p, connected by the standard Dirac rules or a Fourier transform from the original function. The coherent state basis, given by the coherent state matrix element with an abstract vector. Again, this standard decomposition. And here's the integral representation for that. But for the first time, I've introduced the omega parameter. Omega factor was in some Star Trek. Sorry about that. Omega factor here as the width of the Gaussian that's associated with it. We're going to play with that a little bit. So that enters here in this formula here. Now, I'd like to keep that on the screen. May I have a coffee cup empty? Well, I don't care if it's empty or not. And make some additional comments about this. You don't need the handle in our way. Some additional comments about this collection here. Let's look at this formula very carefully. Suppose I integrate over p. If I integrate over p, that's a phase vector. That's the only place it appears. It brings down a Dirac delta function of q minus x. That evaluates this integral, psi, and gives me psi of q. And with the appropriate numerical factors, I can recover the Schrödinger representation, as I like to say, by integrating out the unwanted momentum. There it is. Secondly, let's look at this equation right here with omega super large, really very large. And that puts the support of this integral nearly where q equals x. Apart from a proper numerical factor, which we can adjust for, as omega goes to infinity, this also becomes a Dirac delta function at q minus x. So I can construct directly out of this function in the limit that omega goes to infinity, with a free factor here, wave function. Now, let's let omega go to zero. When omega goes to zero, where are you, my coin? Here's my expression. When it's out, then I nearly have the Fourier transform expression right here, apart from a phase factor. So I have that phase factor, I get the Fourier transform function with a suitable weighting coefficient, and I have the Fourier transform. In other words, the coherent state function interpolates between the Schrödinger representation and the Fourier transform. Very valuable idea.
Too bad.
Okay, coffee can be returned to its rightful owner. Now, I want to take one basic identity here, which is this propagator. I want you to think of it as a path integral. It's too much to write down as a path integral, but I want you to have that in mind. There's time involved to evaluate that. We can use the path integral. But I can also go from x to p over a path integral and then change the basis at the end back from p to x. Or I can go from x to a coherent state and then finally change the basis at the end to go back to my x. So this is an identity connection. I'm now implicitly going to make an approximation to this set of integrals. I'm going to make semi-classical approximations for this term, and this term. I know these functions. I don't have to worry about those. I just, for these complicated functions, treated like path integrals, I'm going to replace them by semi-classical. That's what SC stands for. Here, or here, or here. And now I may lose my equality, because this expression, of course, semi-classical on the outside of that would have been the same, but no, this is semi-classical on the inside. Sometimes this will diverge, my semi-classical, but this will not. So therefore, the approximation simply in that case means, pretty bad. Otherwise, when they're not diverging, they are actually quite close to each other. So here's my semi-classical evaluation for these three terms. That's at the bottom of this page. Here's the summation over the trajectories, the extremal trajectories you typically get in doing a stationary phase approximation. There's an amplitude factor and a phase factor that comes from that. And EP is an summing over the extremal paths. In the next transparency, I'll show you some example with extremal paths, but you have to imagine that for the moment. So here's the semi-classical case for the x to x. For x to p, there is another phase factor, which we're not going to worry about the phase factors. We're going to focus on the amplitude factors with a different form, and we'll discuss that. And for this, from x to coherent state, we have a kind of combination of these. Actually, a very interesting combination. An interesting combination associated with this fact that as omega gets huge, with a suitable coefficient, I go to the position representation. Now watch. As omega gets huge, with a suitable coefficient, that drops out, and I go from I x tilde, we're right there. On the other hand, if I go to omega tiny to small, it drops out here, and I go back up to this one. So here, that amplitude factor, again, is an interpolation between those two forms. Okay. Give me 4 minutes here, 3 minutes. Okay, so here are the extreme paths. From x prime to x double prime, I have illustrated three basic paths. One of them is thicker than the others, and I'll come back to why that's thicker. It's like crossing between Bergen and Trondheim. There's so many hills and mountains in the sun between. There are different ways of which it's convenient to go. And these paths are here as differentiated by their initial or final slope. They both start and end at the same position, so what distinguishes them? Well, how they started off. This one started this way, etc. Now let me talk about linearized deviations. We have a solution in our mind of the Hamilton equations. I just want to take an infinitesimal deviation from the starting point. That will give me an infinitesimal deviation from the whole path. I do that by looking at the Hamilton equations with slight small corrections. That's what the tildes are supposed to represent here. Expand this out to powers of first order in x tilde, etc. That gives me these two equations here. These are the linearized deviations from Hamilton's solution. Notice that they are linearized. This is a fixed function coefficient depending on the original solution, and these are the functions of interest to me. And since it's linear, if I give you the initial data at time 0, there's some matrix which tells you the final data is time capital T. Okay, I'm talking about them being infinitesimal, that's their physical character, but I can always rescale them because they're linear. The equations won't differ, and I'm going to actually have to do that. I'm going to make this start at 0, x tilde 0, but p tilde starts at 1. Okay, so those are the x tilde and p tilde that appeared in the previous transparency. That is to say, in the amplitude factors down here, x tilde and p tilde. Okay. Now notice, you could never have x tilde and p tilde simultaneously zero. If they were both zero, then they would, at some time they would be zero for all time. That's a property of this situation. When x tilde is zero, that means you're at a caustic. Caustic. What is a caustic? Caustic is kind of illustrated by this heavy curve up here. This heavy curve says there are nearby paths, many paths, which start here and end here, but have very, very tiny deviations in their initial slope. I just flown back and forth to Spain, and I have it in my mind once again. As you fly over a body of water, and the sun is shining, there can often be a little wave in the water, which gives to you, your eye, a collection of rays, stronger than the single ray that you would normally get from a flat surface. That's a caustic. You have got many rays here. They all have different momenta, different angles, but they all come to the same position here. That makes a bright spot. And the bright spot says you've got to have an amplitude which is larger. Larger. Well, since you're making an approximation already to the amplitude, the only thing that this amplitude can do is diverge. It doesn't know else how to make it stronger. That's a caustic. This is called a pseudo-caustic, where it's not the positions which give you trouble, it's the momentum which gives you trouble. So here is a schematic solution to x tilde and p tilde as a function of t. You start out at 1 for p tilde and 0 for that, and you move along in the curve, and sometimes you will cross places where p tilde is 0 or x tilde is 0. And when you do that, you're coming to caustics or pseudo-caustics. That's where that formula expression vanishes. Those of you who've heard of the Maslow approach to caustics, his introduction was of the second formula, which has the p tilde. So when the x tilde fails, his formula for p tilde will work. However, they both have their places of failure. But let's look at the semi-classical approximation amplitude given by the coherent state. It's p tilde plus I omega x tilde. Nowhere do both of these vanish. Since they're both real, they never vanish. How can that possibly be? How can that possibly be? Moreover, you have not an summation over extremal paths for this coherent state situation. You have one amplitude. How can that be? The key is, at the top of this board, integrating over the unwanted p will give you the final solution. And integrating over the unwanted p in this equation is the same as integrating along and picking up a signal from here, a signal when the slope is like that, and a stronger signal when it's pointing in that direction. Okay. I just want to conclude to you that this improvement on how wave analysis is done is not restricted, of course, to quantum mechanics. It's done for any wave procedure, electromagnetic or acoustic. And this procedure of using the coherent state amplitude is actually used in oil exploration by Chevron and underwater detection of moving vehicles by other people. Okay, that concludes today's lecture. And...